My first Liberty mentor was Leonard Liggio, president of this august gathering from 92 to 93 and again from 94 to 95. I've heard of the Philadelphia Society for many years, but this is my first opportunity to be here, and I'm very grateful, Lenore, for the invitation. We'll know in about 12 to 15 minutes if I ever get invited again. I want to talk about an odd juxtaposition over the last 50 years. On the one hand, Cato, Heritage, Atlas, Hillsdale College, and others have grown tremendously. Every state now has an SPN-affiliated institute, and the student market seems to be saturated, and happily so, by Students for Liberty and other programs. Parallel to this impressive growth in the Liberty Movement, the federal debt over the last 50 years has jumped from $3 trillion to $31 trillion in inflation-adjusted dollars. The debt-to-GDP ratio has grown from 32 to 120%. I could go on with a lot of other numbers, but especially if we add to that neo-Marxism, the decline in K-12 education, the mediocrity of higher education, and the rise of Taylor Swift, things are not looking good. What do we make of all this? It's often tempting for Friends of Liberty, I think, to take the counsel of despair. But we would not be here today if we were the sort to take the counsel of despair. One answer, I think, is that the victories over the past 50 years, though they be but little, are fierce. First, amidst the rise in the size and scope of the state in the past 50 years, we have seen tremendous victories. Deregulation of trucking, airlines, and telecommunications, the top marginal tax rate falling from 70 to 37%, the corporate tax rate falling, the Reagan Revolution, the Thatcher Revolution. There is some hope. Second, we've seen local victories like lower taxes, high levels of state-based economic freedom, school choice, pushback against neo-Marxism and CRT. And though it be a double-edged sword given the decay of civil society, marijuana legalization, which contributes in its own small way to decreasing the size and power of the state. Third, what I like to call bypassing victories. We still support the postal monopoly through taxes, but FedEx is there in case a package actually needs to arrive. The Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 increased banking concentration, thus decreasing service and consumer choice, and the Durbin Amendment threw an extra million Americans outside the formal banking sector. But they can now use smartphones, which now have a 90% plus penetration rate and are no longer playthings for the richest of Americans. Fourth, even if the Liberty Movement has become a growing echo chamber with limited effectiveness, and I'm not saying it has, but sometimes it's tempting to think it is, there are positive aspects. The ability for friendship with like-minded men and women of goodwill has increased, as has the thickness of marriage markets. Economist Brian Kaplan has suggested that the simplest thing Friends of Liberty can do to advance the free society is to get married to each other and have children. If that's the case, maybe we stop weeping at the world, sharpen our oyster knives, marry fellow classical liberals, and raise little citizens who will do the same. Liberty then becomes a consumption good, and that's not entirely bad. Finally, if nothing else, we are training ourselves to be ready, as Albert J. Nock's Isaiah prophets, ready to brace up the remnant. Much like Isaiah, we are all frustrated because we feel so ineffective. So what do we do now? First, I think we need to check our premises. It seems the guide star for the Liberty Movement has been Hayek's 1949 essay mentioned this morning, The Intellectuals and Socialism, and later iterations such as Richard Fink on the structure of social change. The strategy, of course, was to influence the secondhand dealers and ideas with an emphasis on think tanks to influence policy, along with the creation of free market scholars and university centers. But what if Hayek was wrong? I shudder to say that. But what if he was wrong? We have, after all, not significantly changed the climate of ideas in the past 50 years, at least not as reflected in policy. Have we been ineffective, or have we been speed bumps on the road to serfdom? Things could indeed be worse, but they could surely be better. This leaves us, I think, with two options to consider. First, go directly into policy rather than think tanks. This strategy seems to have worked well with reform-minded economists joining the staff of various regulatory agencies and congressional offices in the 60s and influencing the deregulation of the 70s. Perhaps we should all go out and be the next Alfred Kahn. But there's something unpalatable about working for the state. Second, we can double down on the victories from the past 50 years and focus on political entrepreneurship and cultural entrepreneurship. Ah, yes, entrepreneurship, the title of this panel, I had not forgotten. This brings us to political and cultural entrepreneurship. Pete Betke at George Mason University, in his inimitable style, talks about the three horses of entrepreneurship. The first is the Smith horse for Adam Smith and entrepreneurship from trade. The second is the Schumpeter horse for Joseph Schumpeter and entrepreneurship from innovation. The third horse is the stupid horse for bureaucratic efforts to regulate or incubate entrepreneurship. The stupid horse keeps bumping into Smith and Schumpeter, biting them, kicking them, and taxing them. But as long as Smith and Schumpeter can outrun stupid, the economy will continue to grow. This highlights the importance of the institutional environment within which entrepreneurs act. When I was the editor of the Journal of Entrepreneurship and Public Policy, this is what I emphasized. The world already has hundreds of journals of entrepreneurship, but still lacks careful study of the environments within which entrepreneurs operate. The economist William Baumol argued that the institutional environment affects the incentives of entrepreneurs and will affect the kinds and outcomes of entrepreneurship. With the right institutions, entrepreneurship will be productive. Entrepreneurs will engage in a positive-sum game conducive to economic growth and innovation. With the wrong institutions, entrepreneurship will be either unproductive, a redistributive zero-sum game in the great game of rent-seeking, or worse yet, destructive, a negative-sum game as entrepreneurs turn crony, face incentives to fleece others, and create a net drain to the economy as deadweight losses add insult to the injury of redistribution. This brings me to my main suggestion today. I express it with caution and humility, as many people in this room have spent many hours over the past 2, 3, and sometimes 5 decades thinking about a strategy for advancing liberty, and many people in this room have done a fine job of this Sisyphean task. My overall suggestion is to focus our efforts. Let's find the linchpin and focus on it. I submit that freedom is about capacity and opportunity. This means focusing first on K-12 education, and second, on economic freedom with an emphasis on barriers to entry. I would happily be convinced over coffee or lunch that there is another linchpin, but I think those two make freedom the most relevant, thus countering the left's long march. Without basic education, nothing else will matter. Ignorant voters will demand more government. Unprepared high school students will clog college classrooms and rack up student debt. Readers incapable of critical thinking won't question the mainstream media or reject the rise of neo-Marxism. Let's accelerate the efforts of the Institute for Justice by breaking the state stranglehold on education and double down on the efforts of entrepreneurs like Kerry McDonald and James Tooley, who are implementing alternatives to a failed system. And let's face it, the left runs circles around us when it comes to telling stories. Capitalism is the world's greatest anti-poverty program and the only moral economic system because it's based on voluntary exchange. Yet the left has successfully portrayed it as fundamentally flawed and exploitative. Then again, we don't have much capitalism in this country. The federal government controls 25% to 30% of the economy, state and local governments another 20%, and we can add 10% for regulatory compliance. This means that about half the American economy is run by commissars in the federal city or state capitals, with the expected consequences of lingering poverty, thwarted social mobility, racial tension, and more. And capitalism gets the blame. Unleashing America's creative forces through a combination of educational and economic liberation would increase opportunity and decrease dissatisfaction, while also telling the story of markets and liberty. I know my remit today was entrepreneurship, and we desperately need political and cultural entrepreneurs to push back against the left's long march through the institutions. But I suggest that before we focus on entrepreneurship for liberty, we need to change fundamentally the environment within which entrepreneurs work. I know I was asked today to talk about culture, and culture is important. In fact, it's crucial. But I don't think we'll get anywhere in changing the culture if we continue to have vast swaths of the population that are ignorant, incapable of critical thinking, and brainwashed by neo-Marxist teachers. And we will not change the culture of entrepreneurship, whether traditional or cultural, so long as institutional incentives push many would-be captains of industry into unproductive or destructive entrepreneurship. In closing, let us resist the urge to use the coercive apparatus of the state in an attempt to advance liberty and change the culture. Like Tolkien's One Ring, the administrative state must be cast into the fires of Mount Doom. We cannot hope to wield its power virtuously, and we run the risk of destroying what is left of civil society and markets. Freedom is far too precious. Thank you.